WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
Now, to justify these aggressions, U.S. leaders conjure up fairy tales. They demonize the targeted people. Once you demonize the leaders. Once you demonize the leaders, you can target the people and bomb the people, apparently, as with the Serbs and Milosevic, as with the Iraqis and Saddam Hussein. Let's go back to 1990-91, because it sounds very familiar what's happening today. George I, Pappy Bush, Junior's father, was president. We were told that we had to bomb and kill lots of people in Iraq because Iraqi was threatening to invade Saudi Arabia. There was no evidence of that. Iraqi troops never massed on the Saudi border. It was said that Iraq was committing atrocities. We heard stories about the 500 babies that the Iraqi soldiers came into Kuwait and tore these 500 premature babies from incubators. Many of us wondered about that. 500 babies in incubators at one time in a country of, what, a couple of million people. All of L.A. County has only 40 incubators. What was Kuwait specializing in premature babies? Didn't matter. Some years later, we discovered that that story was a total fabrication, wasn't it? Invented by the ambassador's daughter or something, and it came out in congressional hearings. This is all, everything I'm telling you is public record. We were told that Iraq refused to negotiate when it was in Kuwait. That was false. Iraq was eager to negotiate. In fact, the French had started negotiations with the Iraqis, and Bush the First said, they called that their nightmare scenario. Isn't that an interesting thing? That Iraq may actually negotiate a peaceful withdrawal from Kuwait. That was their nightmare scenario, because then they would lose their casus belli, their reason for perpetrating a war against Iraq. We were told that Iraq had invaded Kuwait. That was true. We weren't told about how Kuwait had been slant drilling in the Ramallah oil fields, had been blocking Iraq airline flights, etc. In any case, why attack Iraq for invading Kuwait? When we never attacked Turkey for invading Cyprus, we never attacked Israel and Syria for invading Lebanon, we never attacked Morocco for invading Western Sahara. Not only didn't we attack them, but we sent them aid. We sent aid to Israel. We sent aid to Turkey. We sent aid to Morocco. Another reason given for why we had to go and kill 100,000 people in Iraq was that the war would create jobs. That reason was given by the Secretary of State at that time, James Baker. He said, this war will create jobs. Excuse me? I mean, child pornography creates jobs. Auto accidents create jobs. I'm not kidding. Auto accidents are very good for the economy. Wreckers, tow trucks, mechanics, insurance companies, state troopers, lawyers, medical rehabilitation centers. Jobs, auto accidents create. I'm not being ironic or sarcastic. Auto accidents are good for the economy. What I'm saying is what's good for the capitalist economy is not always good for the people. That's the central theme of my talk. Then in late November 1990, I wrote about this in Against Empire. I have a little section on it. In late November, the Bush administration stumbled upon another reason for why they just had to invade Iraq or attack Iraq. And there was a poll that came out, and the poll said, if Saddam Hussein is developing nuclear weapons, nuclear missiles, I think it was, nuclear bomb, whatever, would you support military action against him? And that, a very lukewarm public up to then, that brought in a yes of about 70% or something. That became the major theme. And isn't it interesting that 11 years later, That is still the major thing, that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, nuclear capability, and the like. We're told today that Iraq has chemical and bacteriological weaponry. That's another charge that was true. It's true. But whose fault was that? Those factories have been destroyed, dismantled. And how did they get them in the first place? And from whom? I'll tell you where they got them from. They got them from the people who pretend to defend our interests, the people who run this country. That's where they got that nuclear, that chemical and bacteriological warfare. As a Republican congressman, Ron Paul, just said the other day. Again, it's all a matter of public record. I'm gonna quote some of his statements when I get to them in another minute. That's still not. There's another fact that got lost down the memory hole, that the chemical bacteriological warfare weaponry was given to Iraq by the U.S. with approval to use it in Iran, looking the other way when they used it against the Kurds. And now, hypocritically, to charge them, you know, to charge them with crimes which we were complicit. We, did I say we? Ooh, bow, boom, bam, bam. I don't want you doing that. which the U.S. was using. We're told that there's no democracy in Iraq. Well, whose fault is that? Again, who put Saddam Hussein into power? Who put him into power? It was the CIA who put him into power, and his mandate, his job was to destroy the Iraqi Democratic Revolution. And that's what he did. He destroyed the Kurdish Democratic Party. He destroyed the Iraqi Communist Party, which was a reformist party. He destroyed the whole left wing of his own Ba'ath Party. He destroyed them. And he destroyed that revolution. He set up a military dictatorship, which was supported, advised, trained, and equipped and paid for by the U.S. But then he got out of line on oil prices. He got out of line on the question of economic self-development. He proved himself to be an economic nationalist instead of a proper comprador leader who says, come on in, Fortune 500, anything you want, on your terms completely. I'm not going to argue any terms for you. Anything you want, it's your oil. It just happens to be in our ground, in our land, but it's your oil. You just give me my cut. That'll be good. He didn't do that, so he had to be dealt with, you see. So why, if all these reasons are false, then why are these guys hyping up, revving up for a war against Iraq? Now, there you have a choice of two things. You can just say, they're so stupid because I'm so smart. I'm so much smarter than they. I see confusion. No, no, no. Just because you don't know what they're doing doesn't mean they don't know what they're doing. You know? They're so stupid, these people who own and control the world and its resources. They just bumble along. Otherwise, you have a conspiracy theory, right? You think they actually think about these things and have intentions. Oh, weird. Weird. Well, I think there are what I just said, very important, vital, strategic reasons for targeting Iraq. The reason which is to maintain this global empire that makes the world safe for the Fortune 500. For the multinational corporations, to prevent any alternative or independent political and economic entities from emerging, to be not only the only superpower, but to be the supreme monopower, the totalistic global power. So there's this total strategic imperial goal. The second goal is there are very compelling political reasons, just as there was in 1990, 91. Bush was facing the savings and loan scandal that was about to blow open, wide open. and would have taken down his administration and put at least two, possibly three of his sons into jail if the thing had really been unpeeled, as it was starting to be unpeeled on evening primetime television. Blew it right off the screen, just like they've blown off the Harkins and Halliburton scandals. Political reasons. A war against Iraq distracts people from domestic problems and major scandals and from a recession. It justifies increased military spending. It fuels the patriotic hype. People, in turn, rally around the flag, and that flag is wrapped around the president. It increases his poll ratings. His approval rating already has gone up from 60 to 67% just these last 2 weeks, the more militant he's become. It diminishes the momentum behind dissent. Wrong there. It's going to activate and increase dissent. In this case, as it was with George I, the political reasons also bleed into the personal reasons. Is that right here? You've got the president and the vice president of the United States who were only a few weeks ago under investigation. It was the front page story. You had the whole Republican Party facing a disaster. It was the party of big corporate business. Now it can be, once again, the party of military strength, the party of military leadership, the party of saving America's defenses, etc. You had the president and the vice president under investigation for fraudulent accounting, false claims of profits at Harkin and at Halliburton, respectively, Bush and Cheney. False claims of profits to pump up stock values, and then heavy insider unloading of that stock just before it crashes and is revealed to be worthless. Both of those guys, both of them in that. You've got both of them refusing to explain their actions during those periods or having given false explanations. So that's the third reason. There's a personal reason. These guys is watching for their own skins. And then there's a fourth reason for targeting Iraq, and that's oil. Iraq has top quality oil, the best in the world. It has the largest reserve in the Middle East, except for Saudi Arabia. 45 billion barrels at $25 a barrel is $1 trillion of oil. And both the president and vice president do not only represent oil, as every president has, they are big oil. They are themselves oil men. They're in it up to their necks. The Iraqi oil reserve is mostly publicly owned. Not a drop of it belongs to the U.S. oil cartels, although French and Russians are coming in on it. Saddam Hussein has made some agreements with private companies for exploitation, but not with U.S. The London Financial Times, 24 February 98. Oil prices fell sharply because of the weekend agreement between the United Nations and the Iraqi government. Oil prices dropped sharply because peace was threatening to break out. Isn't that interesting? There was concern that, quote, much larger volumes of Iraqi crude oil would compete for market shares. Duh, they want to own it. They don't want to bring it on the market just now. The news prompted further gloom for the stocks of oil companies, which have fallen sharply over the past couple of months. San Francisco Chronicle, just 2 days before that, February 98, Iraq's oil poses threat to the West, was the headline of the article. To the West? We're the West. Do you feel threatened by Iraq's oil? Do you feel threatened by Iraq's oil? No. No. They mean it poses a threat to Western oil investors, not the West. It's not geography that's just happening. There are people doing things, pursuing particular interests. If Iraq is able to re-enter the international oil market, this is the Chronicle story, it would devalue British North Sea oil, undermine American oil production. Do we know any? Can you name two people who are have a key benefit? Beneficial, benefiting interest in in oil production. And much more importantly, it would destroy the huge profits which the United States stands to gain from its massive investment in Caucasian oil production, especially in Azerbaijan. The suspicion that oil prices and profits are playing a role in the Clinton administration's threat is only increased by the UN's refusal to allow any income for the sale of Iraqi crude to be used to repair and maintain the company's oil wells and pumping stations. So they want to keep that country prostrate, you see. The Iraqis have been falsely accused by the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, and by the President of the United States, George Bush, falsely accused of noncompliance. There were UN inspections in 1998. There have been monthly inspections by UN observers every month right up to more recently, and Iraq has been in compliance. 427 sites. This is the Iraqi foreign minister saying. We have 427 sites they wanted to inspect. They inspected all of them. They charged non-cooperation in 5 cases. In those 5 cases, one of them was they wanted to inspect the small headquarters of a political party, the Arabic Socialist Party. We asked them, what's the relationship between small headquarters of a political party and a disarmament mission? They didn't answer. These are the kinds of violations. Another was a guest house where they ran into the same things. It had been the Director General of Security. It had been his headquarters. It had been converted into a guest house. They raised issues. Why would you want to investigate a guest house? There was a delay of about 40 minutes when they posed these questions. This was called noncompliance. It was a delay. You see, they're going in with this like this, like these drug SWAT teams. Oh, you're hesitating there. That means there's some guy in there who's throwing all the secret stuff down the toilet or something. They did get to investigate the guest house, and nothing was found there, and that was still issued as a noncompliance. These were the level of noncompliances. Another one was they refused to open up things that were closed on Fridays. They said Friday evenings most things are closed. You could always, if anything's open on Friday, you can look at it, but you have to wait till the next day. That was the level of noncompliance, and we're not being told that. And overlooked in all of this is that the U.S. National Security State itself has weapons of mass destruction. And who gives this country, who gives the leaders of this country the right to decide who can have what weaponry, who can kill who, on just some speculation? And they've used those weapons again and again. They've used that mighty military force against Panama, Grenada, Nicaragua, Yugoslavia, Iraq, Afghanistan. You can go on. Destroying their infrastructures, wrecking whole generations of people, destroying jobs, their economy, destroying their environment. Crimes against international law, crimes against humanity, crimes against the U.S. Constitution, crimes against the U.N. Charter. Well, if Bush can pull it off against Iraq, he'll try it against Iran and against Cuba and eventually against Venezuela if he can't get rid of Chavez through the usual destabilizing strangulation techniques. And this is the foreign policy of the plutocratic batterer. It's a batterer's foreign policy. You batter and you beat and you apply just so much punishment and pressure until you get compliance just as you want. And then when they start to comply, then you stop the battering. Once Yugoslavia put in a pro-West government and opened up everything and began privatizing everything, the battering stopped. And so it would with Iraq. There is opposition, though, strong opposition throughout the Middle East, Europe, especially in Greece, and now in Germany. You have Gerhard Schroeder, slimy, opportunistic, right-wing social democrat, just like Tony Blair and Bill Clinton, but suddenly coming out as a man of peace in the election and won re-election, squeaked through because he was 17 points behind a few months ago, and he won the election because he came out against engaging in the war against Iraq. Let's see what he really does now that he's been re-elected. Let's just see what he does, though. You have the Saudis themselves saying that they're worried about the public reaction in their country, and they don't want to go in full force against Iraq. And they're also beginning to get a little uncomfortable about their great benefactor and allies, the Americans. If you can do this so arbitrarily, so omnipotently there, what might you do with us if we have a falling out sometime? So there are people all around who are questioning this sort of thing. Well, here's some questions that were raised by, do you want to hear this thing by Ron Paul? Should I tell you about this? Here's some of the questions he raised. He's a Texas Republican, member of Congress from Texas. And he got up in the House of Representatives September 10. And these are the questions he raised. Is it not true that the reason we did not bomb the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War was because we knew they could retaliate? Is it not also true that we are willing to bomb Iraq now because we know it cannot retaliate, which just confirms that there is no real threat? You didn't know that you were going to be applauding a Texas Republican before tonight. That's attaway. And it can be found in all sorts of odd places. Is it not true that the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency was able to complete its yearly verification mission? I'm sorry, I call it monthly and that was wrong. Its yearly verification mission to Iraq just this year with Iraqi cooperation. Is it not true that the intelligence community, that phrase, the intelligence community, there's just a community, CIA and all that. Isn't it not true that the murderous pig operations conducted by the CIA, all right, okay, intelligence community, has been unable to develop a case tying Iraq to global terrorism at all, much less the attacks on the United States last year? Does anyone remember that 15 of the 19 hijackers came from Saudi Arabia and that none came from Iraq? See, if they had all come from Iraq, that would be made an issue. So I think it's fair to make it an issue that they didn't come from Iraq, just polemically speaking. Was former CIA counterterrorism chief Vincent Canestraro wrong when he recently said there is no confirmed evidence of Iraq's links to terrorism? Why are we taking precious military and intelligence resources away from tracking down those who did attack the United States and who may again attack the United States and using them to invade countries that have not attacked the United States? How can Hussein be compared to Hitler when he has no navy or air force and now has an army one-fifth the size of 12 years ago, which even then proved totally inept at defending the country? They weren't inept. They were just pulverized by vastly more massive firepower that destroyed them. Is it not true that the constitutional power to declare war is exclusively that of the Congress? Should presidents, contrary to the Constitution, allow Congress to concur only when pressured by public opinion? Are we willing to bear the economic burden of a $100 billion war against Iraq with oil prices expected to skyrocket? Oh, yes, that's what they like. Nothing wrong. They got nothing. The Bush-Cheney boys have nothing against skyrocketing oil prices. Remember that. Remember, they are what? Wealth addicts, right? And would this not further rattle an already shaky American economy? Iraq's alleged violations of UN resolutions are given as reasons to initiate an attack. Yet, is it not true that hundreds of U.S. resolutions have been ignored by various countries without penalty? Did former President Bush, that is George I, did he not cite the UN resolution of 1990 as the reason he could not march into Baghdad That was the reason. He just didn't want it. They got worried that if they got rid of Saddam, there might be a democratic revolution coming, and they just weren't sure, and Bush was facing an election, and he wanted it all settled, neat and clean. That's why he did. Okay, but it's true. He cited the UN resolution. He was suddenly respectful of it as to why we could not march into Baghdad. But is it not true that supporters of a new attack today assert that it is that this UN resolution is the very reason we can march into Baghdad? Is it not true that, contrary to current claims, the no-fly zones were set up by Britain and the United States without specific approval from the United Nations? That is not what is being claimed now. The impression you get now is that they're doing the United Nations job here of surveilling Iraq. And incidentally, the bombing of Iraq has never stopped. It isn't going to be going on. It has never stopped. Every week there's one or two sorties out there. I was in Iraq in 2 years ago. I was there only for a week, and a school was hit by U.S. planes. And two teachers were killed, and four students were badly injured. How can we declare, this is Ron Paul, Congressman Paul, continuing, how can our declared goal of bringing democracy, how can our declared goal of bringing democracy to Iraq be believable when we prop up dictators throughout the Middle East and support military tyrants like Musharraf in Pakistan, who overthrew a democratically elected president? That is pretty good for a Republican. Here's even the better one. I mean, are you familiar with the 1994 Senate hearings that revealed the United States knowingly supplied chemical and bacteriological materials to Iraq during the Iran-Iraq War and as late as 1992, including after the alleged Iraqi gas attack on a Kurdish village? Then he goes on to say that that attack apparently was not conducted by Iraq. I don't want to go into all of that. It's pretty old stuff. Just a couple of more things. Here's another question he asked. Why do the oil company executives strongly support this war if oil is not the real reason we plan to take over Iraq? What is the moral argument for attacking a nation that has not initiated aggression against us and could not if it wanted to? Anyway, that's what we got there. Now, that's a good sign. That's a good sign. Did you all notice how Ron Paul's dramatic dissension from his own party and criticism of his own president? You notice how that all got on the air over this last week? Weren't you just riveted listening to him? Have you all heard these interviews of him and you all saw this? Have you? No, you didn't. I was just kidding you. Yes, that's right. But we see this thing going on. As I said, there's opposition developing in Greece and Germany and Italy and the United States. There's a lot of opposition all over the world. It's not reported, but it's happening. Opposition just this week, Marin County. I spoke in Marin this past Saturday, and Zhenya Spake, who was one of the peace organizers there, he said, our candlelight vigil was usually about 10 or 12 people, and we had 150 people candlelight. He said, and the cars came by. It was nonstop, the beeping of the horns, beeping, beeping. Everybody giving thumbs up. Nobody gave the finger. Nobody gave the middle finger. It was all thumbs up. And beeping their horns, people were really feeling. And we thought we'd have a demonstration, our first demonstration in March. We were hoping to get 500. We got over 2,000 people. 2,000 people. in Marin County. Marin. People abandoning their hot tubs and skipping their yoga and meditation classes and getting out there. Now, if 2,000 people can do it in Marin, I say Santa Cruz can do 5,000 or 10,000. And the goal is to build up these coalitions, build a base of opinion, do these two things. One, you organize horizontally, and also you impact and organize vertically. You take that base, that it's not one, two step, those two are going on simultaneously, and you target our leaders. You target them, our leaders. You target those oil leaders. You target them and you pressure them and you let them know that the people here don't tolerate this kind of war of aggression. They don't think they're not interested in your opinions. Oh, my friends, they're so interested. They follow, they listen, they bring people. I don't know who he is. I don't want to point him out. And maybe that clean-cut guy there, I don't know. But they track, they listen, they tap our phones, they do all these things. They are so keenly worried. They know that they stand on our shoulders, and if we begin to move and rumble and really get it together, they begin to really sway and shake up there. Remember, brothers and sisters, when the people are ready to lead, the leaders will eventually follow. Thank you very much.
Dr. Michael Parenti speaking last week in California.
Turn on the television. Open up a magazine. Hear them broadcast the massacre. Read about some tragedy. See the men with pretty face. Summarize daily news. Turn the pages, hear the whispering. Follow the voices. Telling you everything's fine, everything's okay. Don't you worry about a thing now. All our problems go away. Everybody. Everyone look the other way. Everything is just ending. There's no trouble here today. Cincinnati just the other day. Another black man was shot dead. 20 bullets from the barrels of a police gun. Shot him in the back while he fled. The people rose up, they took to the streets to defy these racist pigs. They met him with batons and their tear gas guns. Everything is okay. Don't you worry about a thing now. All our problems go away. Everybody close your eyes. Everyone looks the other way. Bombing in the name of liberty. In between each gruesome fight, a brand new face will light the screen. Sell us a new car or some shiny lipstick. driving around town in their fancy new car, bearing how much they are worth. Corporate people and corporate lies, corporate lands and corporate sky. But this is just
in a historic vote on October 2nd, the Common Council of Ithaca unanimously passed a resolution opposing a war on Iraq. The resolution was drawn up by Council Member Susan Blumenthal and passed unanimously by 9 members, including Diane Sams, David Whitmore, Susan Blumenthal, Pauline Manos, Pat Pryor, Ed Kogan, Ed Hershey, Caroline Peterson, and Mayor Alan Cohen. Community members filled the council chambers to urge their representatives to vote in favor of the resolution. Many spoke to the issue that this was a very important time for local officials of towns and cities to make a statement to the federal government in opposition to the war on Iraq. Some community members spoke from personal experience opposing war. One man spoke as a World War II veteran who vowed to work for peace after opening a death camp in Germany. Marianne Grady Flores, who had been to Vieques, Puerto Rico, spoke about the people she met there who'd been contaminated with depleted uranium from U.S. Navy bombing practice. and who are suffering from symptoms of radiation sickness, similar to the effects the Iraqi people have been suffering after 12 years of U.S. bombing, which has left more than 800,000 pounds of radioactive uranium dust in their soil. This has led to a 40% increase in childhood cancers and a drastic increase in birth defects. Grady Flores pointed out that the real reason Bush wants to invade Iraq is to control that country's oil reserves, and she asked all present to think about who their moral leaders are: Jesus, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, or Buddha. Would they have us go to war for oil, she asked. On October 1st, the neighboring town of Danby also voted unanimously in opposition to war in Iraq, with 5 members of that council voting. Coming up on Saturday, October 12th, Ithaca will join 80 other towns and cities worldwide in speaking out against U.S. war plans in the Middle East and how space is being used by the Pentagon to coordinate all war on Earth. The action will begin at the boat docks at the Farmers Market just off Route 13 at 1 p.m. on Saturday, the 12th. And on Monday, October 14th, the Green Party of Ontario County, along with other local groups, will be participating in a March for Peace culminating in a Green Party political campaign rally in Geneva. The march will assemble around 9:30 a.m. at the northern end of the municipal parking lot facing Smith Opera House. From there, march participants will walk 1 mile through the Geneva Business District and out to the city's lakefront gazebo on Route 5 and 20. The campaign rally will start at the lakefront gazebo around noon. The Green Party's principal candidates for elected office this fall will be present: Stanley Aronowitz, the candidate for governor; Jennifer Daniels, the candidate for lieutenant governor; Howie Hawkins, the candidate for controller; and Rachel Treichler for the 29th congressional district seat. Mark Dunow, who is the Green Party's candidate for the 24th district, which includes Geneva, has not yet been able to confirm his attendance. Street theater skits and music will be interspersed with the candidate speeches, and there will be a voter registration table nearby. That's Monday, October 14th in Geneva. For more information, contact Chris Nill at area code 585-289-8475 or visit the Green Party of Ontario County website, www.gpoc.org. Last but not least, we'd like to welcome our new listeners on 88.1 in the Ithaca area. The 88.1 transmitter is a project of Ithaca Community Radio, an organization founded by Jesse Lind and myself, producers of this program. In order to put 88.1 on the air, we've borrowed close to $10,000 on our personal credit. If you appreciate being able to receive the programming of WEOS, which we are now rebroadcasting, please consider making a contribution in any amount to help us pay off our debts. For more information on how to donate, please visit www.ithacaradio.org. Ithacaradio.org. Unwelcome Guests also has a website if you want to contact us or hear the MP3 archive of previous programs you might have missed. You can reach us at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the numeral 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. We'll conclude tonight's program with an excerpt from a speech by Yes Magazine editor Sarah Van Gelder, which was given last month at the Reclaiming the Media Conference in Seattle. The conference was held as a counter-convention to the gathering there of the National Association of Broadcasters, the NAB, which is the corporate broadcasters' lobbying organization. And instead of our usual theme song, Unwelcome Guests, performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, We'll go out with another terribly appropriate song by Ethan Miller, whose music has been featured in tonight's program. More information on Ethan Miller's work is available on the web at www.jedcenter.org. That's jedcenter.org. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
My name is Sarah Van Gelder, and I'm the editor of Yes Magazine. And what I want to talk about is some thoughts about where we might go with reclaiming democracy, reclaiming the media, and actually reclaiming America. First, I want to go back and talk a little bit about American history, if you'll forgive me for doing that. We put out an issue of the magazine called What Does It Mean to Be an American Now? And during that process and subsequently, we did a bunch of research into American history. And the conclusion that I got out of that process was that basically America has two main threads of history. It has an empire history, and it has a history of a democratic America. And one of the reasons that so many of us are hesitant to claim patriotism is because we think of America in terms of the empire. And there's incredible atrocities that were done in the name of America throughout our history from the moment that Columbus reached the shores of the New World. Incredible atrocities, and they're atrocities that we have not dealt with as a nation. What we know happened in terms of Native Americans, the slave trade, Manifest Destiny, which suggested that Anglo-Saxons were entitled to the entire North American continent by virtue of their character and their Christianity. I mean, the atrocities go on right up to the present. When I went to Guatemala in the late 70s, I did a little research into the history there and found out that in 1954, our government had overthrown the government of Guatemala because it had not been sufficiently friendly to the United Fruit Company. And what I didn't learn in school was anything about this. I didn't learn about that particular piece of history. I didn't learn that led to decades of genocide of the Mayan people of Guatemala. I didn't learn about the School of the Americas and that our government was training the worst of the torturers and the dictators. I didn't learn any of that in school. So somehow we were doing these atrocious things, but we were kind of keeping that from the American people. Now we've taken that empire the next step with George W., who doesn't even bother to try to hide it. He simply, and the administration simply says, we have the right to overthrow another government if we don't happen to like them. The other excuses are falling by the wayside. So America as an empire is overreaching, in my view. It's got a long history, but it's kind of overreaching. Now that we think we don't even need allies, we can throw away all the treaties. We can make all of our decisions on our own. We can declare war on our own. We don't need anybody else. We are the American empire. We are the sole remaining superpower, and that's settled. Okay? Now there's another America, which is the America of democratic people's struggles. It's a democratic history that, you know, has examples like the Boston Tea Party, which was a group of people who said no to a large corporation, the East India Company, which was trying to monopolize the tea trade. And they said, no, we're not going to let this big corporation determine our economic structure. And they threw thousands of pounds sterling worth of tea into the Boston Harbor. So we have a long history that we can be very proud of. We have a history of an abolition movement, a labor movement, environmental movement, a civil rights movement, anti-war movement. We have an incredible history that we can be proud of, that we can claim is essential to the America that we have today. Our founding fathers, for all their flaws, were correct in one thing, which is that democracy is not something you win and then you have. You constantly struggle for it. And all those movements are a reflection of that struggle. And the movements that we're involved in today are a reflection of that struggle, too. I would say that if you were to actually have a conversation, a focus group, with a group of average Americans, how many of them would actually want the policies of Empire America that involve sending young men and women around the world to destroy, you know, to kill and to be killed in order to maintain the access of U.S. corporations to the resources and labor of other countries around the world? And I bet there's very few people who would say that that's what they wanted, especially if they had an alternative, especially if they could identify America with a democratic America. And that's what I think we can do. Now, what I think is really interesting, especially since 9/11, is that both political parties have become firmly aligned with the empire model. Okay, and I think most of the mainstream media has become firmly aligned with the empire model. And I don't think that's where Americans are. And I want to give you some specific examples of where Americans are at, that things that are being ignored by both political parties and the mainstream media. There's something like 70% of Americans who think corporations have too much power. That's according to Business Week magazine. Okay, that's not a radical poll. 70% think the corporations have too much power. Now, where in the mainstream media is that being discussed? Where in the two political parties is that being discussed? It's not, except for the very minor aspects of accounting reform. 55% believe that we know enough about climate change and its causes that we should act now. Okay? That doesn't mean getting rid of Kyoto. That means acting now, as they're doing in Europe and most of the rest of the world, which is finally getting fed up with waiting for the United States. 97% of respondents to a survey by the Atmosphere Alliance say that we should be increasing the use of new technologies that improve fuel efficiency and conserve energy. Okay? If you ask how many people think there should be new drilling in the United States to get more oil and gas, it's about 6%. How many should think we should be getting more foreign oil in? About 16%. The American people are not interested in us furthering our dependence on the fossil fuel economy. They want alternatives. What are we getting from the administration? Or even from the Clinton administration, for that matter. Universal health care. People want universal health care. I don't have the exact statistics, but I believe it's the majority. 79% said they wanted to see genetically modified fruits and vegetables get labeled. We don't even see any discussion about that. I think that the support for the empire America is only as deep as the threats continue to be believable. I think we can expand the definition of what it means to be an American.
In times of war, the folk singers are supposed to write peace songs, go to candlelight vigils and lead all the people in sing-alongs. They make love, not war, and have no vengeance on your enemies. Meet violence with love and hatred and anger with empathy. Now don't get me wrong, I ain't got nothing against peace songs or going to rallies to call for an end to the guns and the bombs. But in times like these, I feel compelled to declare my support for the ongoing escalation of the war effort. This ain't no peace song. This is a declaration of war, and this ain't no sing-along. This is the rise of a mighty roar. When the towers came down, everyone looked around for a culprit. And the media moguls and corporate elites took the pulpit. Ain't no fault of ours if all these millions are angry, living in rubble and crumbling hovels in poverty. And draped in a flag, they are pointing away at their enemies. United we stand, they say, cleverly shirking complicity. Don't ask any questions, just follow us, we will show you the way. Rise up, America, come bomb another impoverished nation today. This ain't no peace song. This is a declaration of war, and this ain't no sing-along. This is the rise of a mighty roar. Now are the ones calling the shots. Your friends or your enemies? Who are the victims? Who are the innocents? And who commits crimes? And who gets to spin it the next day on the cover of the New York Times? And furthermore, if I may ask, who are they anyway? Who can give us our freedom and then with one vote they can take it all away? Well, I do declare they've exceeded their share of the oxygen. And we will not stand for one more command from their lips again. This ain't no peace song. This is a declaration of war. And this ain't no sing-along. This is the rise of a mighty roar. An eye for an eye will leave us all blind, I have heard it said. Yes, but peace without justice and struggle will surely leave a million more dead. So stand up on your feet and take to the streets. This is no time for fear. Call us traitors or spies and spread all your lies, but we will persevere. It's been said before and I'll say it once more. Let's bring the war home and battle the forces of greed and injustice wherever they may roam. And united we'll stand here in this land of hypocrisy to take back our lives from the rulers and build a democracy. This ain't no peace song. This is a declaration of war. This ain't no sing-along. This is the rise of a mighty roar. No more will we stand idly by while they ravage the earth and hurl flame from the sky. No more will be silent, no more will be still. No more will be pillaged, no more will be killed. No more silent vigils, this time we will roar. We'll call out the traitors and we will declare war. Wall Street vigilantes in mountain retreats, IMF bureaucrats, Monsanto thugs, CIA agents with tests and with bugs, rich greedy landlords and real estate crooks, corporate lawyers with corporate law books, fascists in the White House and fools on the Hill, uniformed puppets with guns set to kill, racist Avengers and Pentagon groups, slick politicians and bankers in suits. Oh, money new, money privileged few, owners of Nike, Chevron, and GQ, pesticide pushers of chemical war, econ departments, Walmart superstores, kings and their armies, and princes and dukes, religious zealots who kill for the truth, free trade agreements and global control, smokestacks and gasoline and ozone holes. This ain't no peace.